Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornellians. I'm your host, Camila Salazar, class of 2016. Today, I'm sitting down, or Zooming with, I guess, with Flory Marquez, 2014 graduate of Cornell School of Industrial and Labor Relations, and present-day co-founder and senior vice president of operations of BlockFi. Welcome, Flory. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, it's great to see you, and I'm really excited to be on here.
Yeah, it's great to see you too. So I should also note that Flory and I actually know each other from our Cornell days. We were both in Alpha Phi together. Flory was a little bit older than I am. Can you tell us a little bit about your time at Cornell? You know, your extracurriculars, your favorite pastimes, maybe your go-to library.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think back. I feel old now. It's been a decade. Yeah, I think when I applied, I remember when I applied to Cornell, I was blown away that I had been able to get into an Ivy League school because I'm the first person in my family to go to undergrad in the US. So that was exciting. And at school, I think I say this and I don't know if it's like the best advertising, but I'm a much better worker than I am a student. So
I'm
going
exactly
into college and undergrad, I didn't really know what I wanted to major in. I was really good at math and I actually graduated high school with like 20 credits. So I was able to, you know, graduate with one semester fewer, which was awesome for student loan reasons. So going in, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. So I majored in industrial and labor relations. And I think what I liked the most about that major was definitely learning more about the law and how to construct arguments. And I actually, strangely, even though I never thought I would work in HR while I was studying it, all of the classes I took on organizational behavior are obviously extremely helpful today because my company now has more than 800 people. So some of the stuff I learned comes in handy. Yes, it's been wild. But yeah, I think, look, Cornell was like where I made some of my best friends, and I'm still really close with a lot of people that all live in New York. I have like a very close group of 10 friends, and it expands into like a network of 40 people. So I think I had a pretty intense social life, and that was probably more of my focus than studies. And then I think getting into senior year, actually halfway through my major, I thought about switching into engineering just because it was more aligned with my love of like math, and I didn't know how to code a little bit, but there was no way that I wanted to add more years onto my education. So I just stuck with ILR, tacked on a minor in economics, graduated, went to work in finance.
Amazing. I definitely resonate with the more focused on social than school one. I was at Cornell, so I love to hear someone say that officially on the pod.
Yeah.
So you kind of touched on this with your reasons for going into ILR, but you graduated in 2014 from the ILR school, a school known for feeding students into law school or human resources. And you already said you kind of were thinking about going to law school. But when you left Cornell, you began working in finance and asset management. So you told us about why you chose ILR, but can you tell us about, you know, your decision to switch your focus, to pivot away from law and towards finance, and how you leveraged this extremely unique degree into the career you have today?
Yeah, so I am a huge believer in just like asking people that I respect questions on how they make decisions. And I always try to find the smartest person in the room and understand how they got to where they are. And while I was at school, I asked like some of my parents' friends or really successful partners at law firms or very successful lawyers. And I remember asking them, like, what do you think of this career and would you recommend it? Time and time again, the most successful lawyers that I met were like, don't go into this field. It's not the same as it used to be. And they weren't like necessarily happy with how the industry had changed over the last few decades. So I decided to heed the advice of those who were successful in the thing that I was looking at. And at that point I was like, all right, if I'm not going to go to law school, then I kind of need to figure out what I'm interested in the world. And I didn't really know what that was. I think what's unique about me is that, or not unique, a lot of people are like this. I'm a generalist. I don't have like a, some people are amazing at like math or physics or have always known that they wanted to be an architect. I had no clue what I wanted to do. I just knew that I'm generally good at problem solving and learning yeah. things from scratch. And so I said, all right, why don't I just work in an industry that is going to help me prove to whoever my future dream employer is that I can work really hard. And that's how I chose finance, which was, if I don't know what I want to do, I might as well make a great salary, pay off my student loans, and put myself in a position to do whatever I want afterwards. So I remember, I think interviewing for finance at Cornell is so stressful because they do the super days. And I remember mm-hmm. walking to class and seeing all these people in like suits and all of these friends who had like three interviews line up and people who had Barclays and JP Morgan and Goldman and all these things. And I wasn't getting any of those interviews. Mm. And I was actually horrible at interviewing. I'd get so much performance anxiety. And I remember feeling, especially going into junior year when you need to like secure the internship to like basically like solidify your future forever, which is how it's yep. marketed, that like yep. just feeling really lost and like I was behind the ball. And then I do think that in life, one thing that I've been shameless about, and I hope that other people can do this as well, is to just reach out to your network. And it's, you get so much farther if someone can introduce you, even if it's like a friend mm-hmm. of a friend or someone who can basically like pull your resume out and put it on top. So I ended up being able to do an internship at BNP Paribas. That was in 2012. And I actually didn't get an offer to join full time. I remember it was heartbreaking. I got put on hold. So I was like, if we have an extra spot, you'll get it. And there's so many points where I just felt like there was no way that I was going to succeed in life because our society puts all of these like standards or thresholds that you have to hit within a certain timeline. And especially in yeah. a place like Cornell, you're made to believe that if you didn't hit that, that you're somehow failing, when the reality is there's so many different ways to be successful and there isn't really a formula. So then going into senior year, through different family friends, I was able to apply to Oak Hill Advisors, which is a fixed income asset management firm in New York City. And I was able to get a job working in investor relations. And ideally, I really did want to be on the investment side to really be able to use more of like the math based and economics major that I had gotten. But, you know, I got a job in investor relations. So I was like, let's just learn as much as I can in this role. And I tried to expand everything that I touched as much as I could. And I really had the opportunity to work on a lot of things related to like macroeconomics and writing like summaries for investors. And that's what I was really passionate about. So I basically did whatever job was available that would allow me to learn more.
And look at you now. You are the president of your own cryptocurrency company, which I definitely want to get into because it's so unique and special and cool. And so just to backtrack really quick, I remember the saying in college that I heard all the time that was kind of like, 5 years from now, you might be working in a job or a career that doesn't even exist yet. And I remember thinking that this was just like mainly a way to calm down us Cornelians that had no idea what they wanted to do post-college. You know, like us generalists, us people that weren't dead set on really committing to like the super day thing, like you said, or not getting those offers because, you know, I mean, I can speak for myself. I was kind of all over the place. So what you were describing, how you felt, was exactly how I felt at that time in my life. But when I think about you and BlockFi, this saying comes to mind, like the career you might have 5 years post-graduation, 10 years post-graduation might not even exist. Like the industry might not even exist when you're in college or high school. And so first off, what did you know about crypto at Cornell, if anything?
Yeah. So I actually didn't know anything about crypto at Cornell. I know now that people were mining and using like the free electricity out of dorm rooms, which, you know, good for you if you got that nice 2013 Bitcoin. But I didn't know anything about crypto. And I actually didn't know that much about like in depth about crypto before I started BlockFi. So basically I worked a couple years in institutional finance. Then I became obsessed with the idea of startups. And I love startups because the sky is the limit. There's so much that you need to build. And for someone like me, that's a generalist, and I just love to learn while I'm working, being able to be in an environment where I can have three jobs. So at my last company, Bond Street, I was in charge of taking care of the investors. And I was also in charge of the loan portfolio and how we took payments. And then I wanted to learn how to do credit underwriting for small businesses. So I raised my hand and I asked the guy that was in charge of it, hey, do you mind teaching me how to do this? And I'll just underwrite a small portion of our loans just so that I can understand the model. Basically, there's no end to the amount of work and amount that you can learn. And I think that's true for any small company. So for people that are looking to do something next, I just really encourage going into those small kind of like shapeless environments of chaos where you can build structure and learn for yourself. And then when that company got acquired by Goldman, I had always known that I wanted to start my own company because, again, going back to what I said about looking at who the smartest person in the room is, I remember looking at the founder of my last company and thinking to myself, like, wow, that'd be really nice to do what he does. Like, that seems cool. And even at Oak Hill Advisors, the two partners that started it 20 years ago were still managing the firm today. And so I think watching them start something when they were so young that allowed them to propel their career forward for decades was also really interesting to me. So I wanted to kind of replicate that or was interested to see if I could do it. So because of my time at Bond Street, I knew how to build financial products from scratch. And specifically, I knew how to build US dollar loans. And I knew my co-founder because he worked for another startup that Bond Street, my last company, worked with. And I saw as the rest of my team was going over to Goldman Sachs that my now co-founder was looking to start a company that wanted to build financial services for crypto. And he knew a lot about crypto and fintech, and I knew exactly how to build financial services. And so I thought, this is perfect because I get bored really easily and I can use what I know, which is building loans, but I don't want to just build loans because I already know how to do that. I want to learn more and be engaged and learn other products. And I know how to interact with businesses, but I really wanted to learn how to interact or build a consumer facing platform. And so the idea of being able to use what I knew, which was loans, and then just learn everything about crypto while I'm working, was extremely exciting to me. And I think I definitely am fearless about making things up from scratch. So I was like, I don't know what this is, but I'll figure it out. And that's what we did.
Yeah, I think fearless is a key phrase also in all of this, because I'm hearing you talk about what I'm seeing, the excitement on your face, talking about, you know, this opportunity that you got and this adventure that you decided to go on. And I'm thinking, wow, you are fearless to have started something, you and your co-founder, to start this by yourselves when you don't know anything about like the big part of the startup that like is going to make it all come together. So I mean, all that to say, you are fearless, Flory. Wow, that's incredible. And
I think that people sometimes think about risk incorrectly, especially if you go to a school like Cornell where there's so much like structure in place in terms of like, you should graduate and be a consultant or work in finance. So when people do things like start their own company that has like no revenues, a lot of people think that that's really risky. But the reality is that if you take 2 years to try to start something on your own, you're just going to learn probably as much as what you would learn by paying for an MBA. And the amount that you learn and the ability to show to others that you took that leap and tried to build something from scratch is going to allow you to do an endless amount of jobs and have an endless amount of opportunities on the other side of it. So I don't really think about it as risky because I figured, look, if this company doesn't work out, I basically got like a free MBA in 2 years and I'll be able to start another company or get a different job that I otherwise wouldn't have been qualified for as a result of me like jumping in and trying to do this myself.
That's a better way to look at it for sure. And I think a lot of people who gravitate towards startups and love startups have that mentality. Is there any sort of advice that you can give to, you know, current Cornellians or maybe recent grads? Like what would you say if someone's on the fence between like trying to do the traditional thing or maybe do take the riskier thing and do the startup route?
Yeah. So I think there's benefits to both. So I think the benefit of working in a traditional institution, at least for a couple of years, is that you learn this level of professional rigor and just they know how to make you work. Like you learn how to do an 18-hour workday. You learn attention to detail. The training program is brutal, but it's stuff that sticks with you regardless of whatever career you do later on. So I do think there's benefits to being in a structured environment that has those training programs and like big teams that teach you like what does perfection look like when you create a product? On the other hand, our first employee, Chelsea, was a NYU senior when I hired her. So she was working part-time and then came on full-time when she graduated. And I remember when she joined, all of her friends were like making fun of her, like, oh, you're joining a scam. Like this company's not gonna exist in 2 years. And she has been able to do the most incredible things over the last 3 years, not to mention like she got that early equity, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. And now her friends are, you know, banging down the door to try to work at this company. So I'm not saying that like it makes sense definitely to work for a startup right out of college, because I do think there are some basic skills in terms of professionalism that you should learn in a more structured environment. But I think that the amount that you can learn in a growing company is a lot bigger and more expansive than you can if, let's say, you're just an analyst at a financial company and you just have one set of responsibilities for the next, you know, 2 to 3 years. So I think the benefit is just expansion of knowledge. It's definitely more chaotic and it's definitely less secure, right? A lot of companies the majority of startups don't succeed. And so I think the number one thing to look at if you are looking at a company, or I would say the number two thing, the top two things to look at is look at the founding team and ask yourself, like, are they smart? Are they good at what they're doing? Are they good people and are they intelligent? And then I think the second thing to ask yourself is like, does this business idea make sense? And you don't need an MBA to answer that question. You should just like, if you're selling a product, if you're you know, building a technology, just take a step back and think like, does the world need this? And if the answer is maybe, then that's an interesting business to work for. If you look at it and you're like, this kind of just sounds like, you know, the fifth iteration of a product that already exists, then that's probably not the best business idea.
Yeah, I think that's really solid advice. So it's 2017 and you have co-founded BlockFi, which is a company that lends US dollars to people that are already invested in crypto so that they don't have to sell off their crypto in order to spend money off of it with it. And then I think it was in 2018 that you officially started lending. Is that correct?
Yep.
So what I gave was an extremely simplified version of, you know, the first product that you guys launched with. And I was wondering if you could explain to us exactly how it works.
Yeah. So BlockFi today, the last time we published our assets under management back in the first quarter, we managed $15 billion in assets. And we basically are a financial services company for crypto. And what that means is we're basically like any other fintech app that you can access on your phone. But we give you the ability to do a little bit more with your assets using crypto. And so we offer three things if you were to download it on the App Store today. One is my favorite product, which is an interest-bearing account. And what that means is you can download the app, connect your bank account, and send cash to BlockFi. The cash gets turned into what's called a stablecoin, which is basically like a Venmo balance. It's worth a dollar, but not actually a dollar. And you can start earning 8% on those assets, which is incredible. We can pay out 8% because it's slightly more risky than a bank account. It's not FDIC insured. And you can actually earn interest on all of the assets. So if you put cash on and you decide to buy Bitcoin, you can earn interest on Bitcoin. You can also earn interest on Ethereum. So once you have assets on BlockFi, you can buy and sell different types of crypto. And then the last product, which is actually the first one that we launched, is the ability to borrow against your assets. So let's say you now have $10,000 worth of Bitcoin and you want to purchase a used car for $5,000. You can actually take out a US dollar loan backed by your Bitcoin, and you get cash and you pay interest and you can pay it down just like a regular loan. So those are the three products that we offer. And today we have, I mentioned, we have over 800 employees across the world. We have, over close to 500,000 clients on the platform. The next product that we're launching, which I actually got to use yesterday, is a crypto rewards credit card. So when you swipe, it's just like a regular credit card, but you earn Bitcoin instead of airline miles. So it's pretty cool to get that offer now that, points are worth less and less every single year. It's been a pretty wild ride. We've grown incredibly quickly, and I'm pretty sure we're the fastest growing fintech company in history, and it feels like it.
I was looking at your Twitter at Founder Flory for everyone out there. And I was watching all the interviews you've done, and I watched that video of you swiping your BlockFi credit card at a pizza place in New York City and explaining like the rewards, and it was just extremely exciting. I was doing that in prep for this interview, and I'm not gonna lie, I think afterwards I'm gonna open one of those savings accounts because 8% is insane.
Yeah, so I think the craziest thing. So I went out to dinner with one of my friends and I actually used the credit card, which isn't live yet for people. It'll be live in a few weeks. And it's insane to go from like myself and my co-founder making things up 4 years ago to having like this physical product that we can use and that hopefully like hundreds of thousands of people are going to be able to use it. And the way that we think about it, which I think is like a huge challenge in crypto right now, is how do we get people used to buying and holding crypto in a way that's like easier to understand? I think a lot of companies in crypto can be a little bit too technical and a little bit too confusing for the average consumer. So our thought process behind the credit card is, how do you make it simple? How do I give someone a product that everybody knows how to use, which is swiping a credit card, and everybody understands points? So how can I get you to like passively get used to holding Bitcoin and learning how incredible this asset is without actually having you have to like give up your own cash to buy it? So that's the thought process behind it. And then our long-term state and why I started the company is because I truly believe in making financial products that are available in the US available worldwide. So I do think that in the US, we give for granted the fact that we can use credit cards and we have savings accounts that you can access at any time and know that you'll be able to get your deposits out if you need them. And not every country in the world has that. And the beautiful thing about crypto is that you can send it internationally instantly without ever having to use a partner bank. And what that means for us is that means I can give people in any country, in any part of the world, access to the same financial products at the same price that I give to users in the US. So today, 30% of our clients are actually from overseas, and that's without us ever having actively marketed our products. That's them finding us, downloading the app and converting themselves. And to me, that speaks for the desperate need that people in other countries like Argentina or India that people have to access these types of products and, you know, earn an interest. In some cases, it's escaping your country's volatile currency and using stablecoin instead. There's so many benefits that go beyond how we think about products in the US, and that's really our long-term goal.
Yeah. A question that immediately comes to mind in terms of what, like the phrasing you just used, like, you know, escaping using the volatile local currency and using stable coin instead, does that affect the local economy in any way? Like, how does that work? Like, how do they, is this mainly for their own like overseas transactions, or does it like, how can you use stablecoin in your local economy if you're overseas? Just how does it work?
Yeah, that question is spot on because right now what we can offer is the ability for someone, let's say you're in Argentina, we give you the ability to escape the peso, which is going through hyperinflation, and access the stability of the US dollar. So stablecoin it's basically like having a Venmo balance and being able to have access to a US dollar, but it's not a physical dollar. And so then the question becomes, great, I've put my savings in the stablecoin on this app, but how do I buy my groceries on the, you know, next week? Like, my grocery store doesn't accept stablecoin. So the answer to that is a future product that we're working on, which is a debit card. So giving people the ability to spend using the assets that they hold on the BlockFi platform. And I think that's less interesting in the US, where we have thousands of debit card options. And also most people are using credit instead of debit. But if you're overseas and you've suddenly used BlockFi as a safeguard for your assets, and then you need to access purchasing power domestically, if we were able to give you a debit card that can be spent in whichever currency you're using, that gives you the ability to, you know, have your savings in dollar equivalent assets and then still, you know, buy your groceries on a weekly basis. And the end impact, to your point about like, how does this impact economies? It gives people in countries with unstable currency finally the ability to start saving and accruing assets. And if you're using a product like BlockFi, making your assets work for you and making your assets generate a passive income for you, which is something people haven't been able to access in certain countries for decades and sometimes ever.
Yeah, that's incredible. And so the idea here is, you know, like we've already said, the local currencies are volatile, but so is crypto. So how do you guarantee that stablecoin, like that the value that people put into stablecoin remains the value that they put into stablecoin? I don't know if that's...
Yeah, we're really going... I love this because we're actually going into like some of the hottest topic questions in crypto right now. And like, actually, what was it about a week ago? Like, some of these questions or similar questions were being asked, in Senate hearings with Elizabeth Warren. But the way that stablecoin works is that independent companies, like for example, one of my favorites is Gemini, will hold physical dollars that represent the amount of stablecoin in circulation. Mm-hmm. So to your point about like, how do I know that I can turn the Gemini stablecoin, for example, is called GUSD. How do I know that whenever I want, I can turn the GUSD into an actual dollar? And the answer to that is it depends on the company that's behind the creation of the coin. Mm-hmm. I think what would be extremely powerful is if the US government actually launched its own stablecoin, because I think that the ability to give people access to US guaranteed cash overseas would, one, make a huge impact on individuals' lives, as we have just talked about. And also, there's this theory. So Chris Giancarlo, who's the former head of the CFTC and also sits on our board, has this theory that in the US, our monetary system is very similar to our infrastructure system, where when we first built it, like when we first were building roads and highways, we were at the head of the world. We were the most competitive. We had the best transit systems. But over the past few decades, as a country, we failed to invest in those systems. Mm-hmm. And as a result, other countries are either catching up to us or in some cases have surpassed us. Mm-hmm. And he believes that the US dollar is in a similar boat, and that as a country, we have to embrace changes in technology and make how we think about our currency and monetary system more efficient in order to stay competitive with the rest of the world. And I think creating like a US government-backed stablecoin would be one step in that direction.
I love what you're saying about innovating the infrastructure, the financial institutions that we've always had, because it's true. You know, America has, or for the longest time, was always seen as this pillar of innovation. And then, you know, before you know it, we are behind on the simplest of fintech, like even like a contactless card, things like that. So I think it would be really interesting to see a future where the U.S. does back this digital coin. And I wonder, does that mean, would that look like an elimination completely of like physical U.S. dollars? Like what would that future look like if we had that system in place? How would it blend with what we currently have right now?
Yeah, so I think that sometimes when you talk to deep crypto people, they think that technological adoption is going to happen overnight. And the reality is that when new technology is invented, I think it takes a lot longer to get incorporated into society than anyone who's working in the field thinks. And so when it comes to US dollars, I do think we're very far away from getting away from physical cash. I think there's some efficiencies that people would get from having a US stablecoin. I think about all these platforms like the Cash App mm-hmm. and Zelle and Venmo and all these other alternatives for using cash, because using physical cash is inefficient and it doesn't really make sense given the technology that we have today that we're still using paper to track spending. So I think there's definitely a period where you just have an overlap of both systems. And I think maybe 20 years from now, we would live in a world where you're not seeing any more physical okay. dollars.
20 years is a lot sooner than I thought you were going to say. So that's kind of cool. So like I said, I was looking at some past interviews that you've done, and a CNBC Fast Money reporter said to you that BlockFi was trying to build a bank on Bitcoin. Which one sounds, and on top of the alliteration, sounds incredibly momentous. So congratulations. It sounds like with all these product offerings that you've explained to us and also the new ones that are coming out, ooh, getting an inside look here. I just want to say congratulations. That is extremely exciting. And I think congratulations are in order. So that's one thing. Two, earlier in this interview, you know, you talked about how you get bored easily. And one of the appeals of starting this company was that you knew nothing about crypto. And so that was an exciting challenge for you. So you've been doing this for, you know, I guess it's been like 3-4 years now. Do you think you're going to get bored of it soon? Like what's the future here for you personally?
Yeah, I think that getting bored is very difficult. I say this to all of our new joiners and people on our team all the time. BlockFi is many things. We will never be boring. We just move at such an incredible speed in terms of what we're building and how we're changing and how we're growing. And for me, over the last 4 years, my job has changed 10 times. So it's every 3 to 6 months, it's like I have a completely different job. So when I first started it, my job was more on building the product. So I was in charge of, what does the loan look like? How is the user going to apply for the loan? How are they going to make payments? What is the license that we need? And I built all of that. And then once it was live, my job was actually trading. So when crypto was tanking at like 3 a.m. and we hadn't automated the system yet, it was my job to go in and sell crypto to make sure that none of our loans defaulted.
Wow.
And like manually send emails to our clients, letting them know, like, we need you to send more assets to like cure your loans margin call. Because none of it was automated. And so that was through 2018. And then thankfully we automated that and built up a team around it. And then in 2019, we actually had to figure out marketing. And I knew nothing about marketing. I didn't know what the difference between SEO and SEM, but I said, all right, I'll just figure it out. So in 2019, at the beginning of the year, we had 100 clients. By the end of the year, we had to get to 10,000, and I did it. And we figured out, you know, really at the core of how to expand our reach, really people need to hear about us through people that they trust, right? Because we're asking you to give us your assets. And in order to do that, you need to trust us. So we basically figured out an omni-channel approach to marketing. We did a lot of sponsorships with podcasts, which worked out very well. And then by the end of the year, I hired out an actual marketing team to take over what I was doing. And then last year, I moved back into what I think is like my bread and butter and the thing I'm best at, which is managing operations and client service. And at the beginning of the year last year, I had about 10 people in total on my team. And today I have over 150 people that I manage. So it's every 3 to 6 months, things change. I have new teams, I have new things to build, new challenges. The challenges you face when you're over 800 people are so different than what I was doing in the early days, where when you're first starting a company, the beauty of it is that the future of the company literally rests on what you do in that week. I could work really hard in 1 week and change the trajectory of what we were doing.
Yeah.
Now that we're a huge company, I can't do that anymore, right? Like, I've pushed the little snowball off the mountain and now it moves on its own. And so my job is very different, and it's a lot more similar to like an orchestra conductor than it is an actual person that can like shift the future. Even though I still can, it's just the effects are much more gradual. So it's, everything's a lot more methodical. So to answer your question, I'm not bored. I don't think I will be bored anytime soon. And my job changes every 3 to 6 months.
Flory, that is amazing. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I'm so excited to see how BlockFi grows. Like that CNBC reporter said, BlockFi is trying to be a bank built on Bitcoin. Well, I don't think you guys are trying anymore. I think you are succeeding, and I'm so excited to see like what the future has for all of us with like the opportunities of crypto, but also for you. So thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. This was super fun. And if I could convince a couple listeners to make the jump to a startup and also to buy some Bitcoin, this will be a good day for me. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Fresh from the Hill. Music for Fresh from the Hill was created by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2013. You can contact him at koa3@cornell.edu. For more information about Cornell Young Alumni programs and how to stay involved, please visit alumni.cornell.edu/youngalumni or visit our Facebook page at Cornell Young Alumni Programs.